Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Chris Hughes. I'm a professor in the Department of International Relations here at the LSC. And it's really a great pleasure to welcome Linda Yuer, who's had a long connection with the LSC and is currently a visiting professor at LSC Ideas, the world's leading university-based think tank for foreign policy. She's also attached to Oxford University, the London Business School, and Chatham House. I won't go into the details of the positions, but you can see them on her webpage, I'm sure. She's also been visiting professor of economics at Peking University. She's published very widely on political economy, China, and so on. And her latest book is The Great Economists, How Their Ideas Can Help Us Today. And that has the accolade of being the Times' best business book of the year. So she's going to talk today on the subject of what would it mean for Britain's economic diplomacy if China becomes dominant in the world economy. And the timing, of course, is absolutely perfect this week because some of us will have been remembering a couple of days ago the events in Beijing in 1989. And also we've had the last 2 days, the visit of Donald Trump and the issue of Brexit coming up. And it brings home to us the fact that the UK after Brexit will be between these big superpowers and have many dilemmas to face, many risks, and I assume many opportunities as well. So, Linda, I hope we'll be able to give us some insights into what to expect and how that will be navigated.
Me too. Okay.
So the lecture will be recorded as an audio podcast, and she's going to talk, I think, around 50 minutes or something, so that will leave about 30 minutes for Q&A at the end. So over to you, Linda.
Thank you, Chris. Maybe I'll stand if I'm sitting in front of this line. Good, and thank you very much, Chris. And I thank you all for coming out this evening have a discussion, I hope, around what would it mean for the UK, specifically for economic diplomacy, if China became dominant in the world economy. It's a very long title for a lecture, so I'm going to break it down into specific parts. The first thing is to say, if you wanted to, at LSC Ideas, we really do like it if you engage in social media, so please do feel free to tweet. There's three different hashtags, so take your choice. Whichever one you can actually remember would be just fine. So please feel free to do so. Let's have a conversation more broadly about some of these issues. So this is what we're hoping that you will do. So I should say, the chair of the LSC Economic Diplomacy Commission. And so it's a new commission, and it is something that we set up in Ideas, and several of my commissioners are actually here to look exactly at this question. So what I'm going to do is to give you an introduction to the topic, focus on really the China aspect, and then lead you through, I hope, some of the issues that still need to be properly explored in order for us to really make sense of a fast-changing global economy. So so the first thing that I'm going to try and do is tell you what economic diplomacy is. So there are many, many facets to economic diplomacy. So these are three key areas that I'm going to focus on. So the very first thing is, how should Britain formulate foreign economic policy? So what do I mean by foreign economic policy? International trade policy, policies around investment, and much more broadly, the UK's role in the world. So, for instance, should the UK take a lead in the next round of WTO liberalization? Where should the UK sit in terms of the global push to combat climate change? So it's about a global role with economic aspects, but obviously this is one part of external policy. The second thing about economic diplomacy, which is worth mentioning, is it's about how this foreign economic policy interacts with foreign policy. So this is one of the issues that certainly comes up when you speak about China, which is not a democracy, and it has a different political system because of the Communist Party being in charge. Obviously, there are issues around China's, in terms of human rights, in terms of its stance on the rules-based system. All of these things mean that foreign policy around China is going to have to be made consistent with foreign economic policy around China. So you could substitute the U.S., you would have different, the same questions, but different considerations. So this is one of the reasons why you have to look at whether your trade and investment policy is consistent with your foreign policy aims. And then finally, and like I said, this is not a comprehensive list. These are just issues, I think, to think about when you want to talk about economic diplomacy, which is what is the domestic impact of these policies that you're setting? So across Britain, how would opening up to greater trade or investment with China affect different parts of the country? So I'm thinking specifically about what's known as the China shock in the economic literature, which was when China entered the world economy and it really put a huge amount of downward pressure on manufactured goods prices, and it contributed to the offshoring of jobs for manufacturing in advanced economies to go to China. So again, how does that affect not just here in London, but how does that affect the economy around the country? So domestic distributional considerations also really matter. As I say, there's plenty of other things we're going to look at in the commission, but I think these are the things that I'm going to spend this evening focused on. So the three parts of my analysis, one is, can China become dominant in the world economy? So the title is, if China becomes dominant. So of course, you've seen the economic forecasts, and they suggest that China will overtake the United States as the world's biggest economy, you know, within the next couple of decades. But one thing to bear in mind, and this is what the great economist J.K. Galbraith said about economic forecasting, that economic forecasting exists to make astrology look respectable. So it's worth just thinking about the if question, but also importantly, understanding China's drive to become economically dominant would give a steer towards dealing with China. What are their aims? What are their ambitions? What are they seeking? So anytime you want to have economic diplomacy relations, it's good to have a sense what the motivations are of the country that you're dealing with. It's obvious, but I think it's worth spelling out. And then I think if you want to talk about economic diplomacy, again, it's about how Britain sets its foreign economic policy. But the context, what is the context of the 21st century global economy? So looking ahead, we're in the 21st century. Things are changing very, very quickly. So what should actually be generally aims of a country that can set its trade and investment policy and its role in the world? You know, what is the context? What are we actually talking about? How should Britain position itself? And then, what are the implications of a dominant China if it should become dominant? What are the implications of how Britain wishes to position itself for the formation of economic diplomacy? So that's the rough outline of what I'm going to try and go through. So the very first part is, can China become dominant in the world economy? So in one sense, China already is, because it is the biggest contributor to global economic growth. It's a bigger contributor than the United States, and this has been the case over the past decade. So since the global financial crisis, China's been a bigger growth driver than the United States. But even before then, so since the 1980s, according to the World Bank, the U.S. and China have been the twin engines of growth in the global economy, global growth. So it comes down a little bit to how you define dominant. So it's already the case that if you want to be selling into the market that drives the most growth, China's already that market. And you see that in some companies that actually sell more to China than they do to the U.S. For instance, Apple, a lot of its sales are in China. And this is actually one of the things I should point out, which is when China, looks at its development, it's always going to view itself as a middle-income country. So I'm going to show you the next chart, which is about how China is seeking to become prosperous. But in aggregate terms, it's already, the economy that is as important to the world economy as the United States. So in terms of thinking about the markets, thinking about the countries we ought to be dealing with, even if China doesn't become the biggest economy, and even if it doesn't achieve its aim of becoming high income, it's already at this stage quite a dominant presence in the world economy. But China's trying to grow rich. So China is seeking to overcome the middle-income country trap. So the middle-income country trap is essentially a description of the fact that most countries in the world are not rich. Only one quarter of the world's countries are high income. Most countries in the world are middle income or developing. And so in many ways, it's quite puzzling. Why aren't more countries prosperous? And China is seeking to become one of the very few countries that could overcome the middle-income country trap and join the ranks of rich countries. To give you an illustration as to how difficult this is, in 1960, there were 101 middle-income countries. By 2008, only 13 of those had become rich. So it's a baker's dozen. It's a very small group that's become rich. But, and here's the big but, China is a very unequal country. So there's probably already 200 to 300 million people in urban areas who are at the income level of advanced economies. So that's consistent with China being a huge market, because the U.S. has a population of over 300 million. China has that many people probably already certainly in the upper middle income, if not rich, category. So the challenge is to bring the rest of the billion people in China, and raise their income level. So this is about average incomes, which is what this chart shows, that average incomes in China are still, even by projecting at current growth rates, still only going to be about a quarter of that of advanced economies. So this is the challenge the Chinese government is focused on, and it makes sense politically, because you want to stay in power, you deliver prosperity, and you need to make sure the billion people who are not currently well off, get there. So this is the overwhelming aim for Chinese economic policy, which is to become prosperous, and for average incomes to, I don't know if they will bridge that gap. Like I said, it's a very difficult thing to do, but this is the overwhelming aim of Chinese economic policy, and it picks up on some of the focus of Chinese policy, such as Made in China 2025. It wants to achieve this by pushing up productivity, for instance. I was just going to say an illustration of the inequality in China is that obviously, so when I go to Harrods, I get great service until they work out I'm not Chinese. there's a term China rich. So have you seen the movie Crazy Rich Asians? Okay, it's great, right? It's hilarious. Rachel Chu, the female, marries, Nicholas Yang. And so Nicholas Yang's from a really rich family. So in book two It's a trilogy. So the first book is Crazy Rich Asians. The second book is actually called China Rich Girlfriend. The third book is called Rich People Problems. But the second book, China Rich Girlfriend, refers to the fact that Rachel Chu, actually, her father, who she doesn't know, is not just rich, he's China rich. And so she actually comes from this fabulously wealthy Chinese family. So it's the inequality the Chinese government is trying to stymie. And obviously the challenge is how do you get the rest of the billion into the ranks of maybe not high income, but upper middle income. So I want to give you a sense of this global middle class in 2030 to kind of set the stage for China's, again, pretty strong role in terms of the transformation of the world economy that we're expecting in the next decade or so. But also, I think, a sense as to the kind of world economy Britain should be thinking about positioning itself in. So this is, and China is a big part of this, 2030 is likely to continue the trend that we have seen really since the early 1990s. You can see the real jump up in terms of the share of world GDP accounted for by emerging and developing economies. So if you break world GDP up into advanced economies versus emerging and developing economies, it's quite clear that the growth of emerging and developing countries meant that their share of world GDP overtook that of advanced economies during the global financial crisis. But it wasn't a one-off. It's actually a trend that is picking up on the fact that China, as I said, has become a driver of global growth, and it's not the only, it's a big part, it's not the only part of the shift that we should see in the 21st century. So why have we seen this big shift? Over a billion people have been lifted out of poverty since 1990. Almost all of that is due to China. And so if you look at this chart, in 1990, people who lived in extreme poverty, so this is people living on less than $1.25 per day, adjusted for what a dollar buys in their country, is the equivalent to $1.90 per day today. That extreme poverty, in 1990, more than a third of the world lived in extreme poverty. Today, we're at a historic point where 1 in 10 live in extreme poverty. So over a billion people in the course of really a couple of decades were lifted out of extreme poverty, and not just that, I'll show you in the next slide, lifted into the middle class. But the analysis shows China's almost, it's predominantly responsible for this drop in poverty. So this is, again, another shift to think about, because they haven't just come out of poverty, they've actually gone into the middle class. So in 2009, 10 years ago, there were 1.8 billion people who are middle class. So what is middle class? A middle class person is somebody who earns between $100 a day to $1,000 a day to $10,000. $10 a day to $100 per day, which gives you $3,500 per year or $35,000 per year. So it captures quite a wide spectrum of people who are middle income. So the, by the way, the definition of somebody in the middle class is not whether you own a mobile phone, because apparently everyone has one. It's actually whether you can afford a refrigerator. And so that's about being able to afford consumer durables. So not having to, you can refrigerate food, you don't have to walk to go and pick up, you know, groceries, all of that. But it reflects the ability to consume consumer durables and also services. So on current growth rates, based on what I showed you in the previous chart before last, is that by next year, 3.2 billion people will have joined the middle class. And by 2030, which is the UN Sustainable Development Goal year, 4.9 billion people out of an estimated 8.5 billion in the world will be middle class. It'll be the first time that more than half of the world is middle class and middle income. And that, again, reflects a trend, a shift in consumption power, where consumers are. And where are these consumers found? The bulk of them will be in Asia. And China is, again, the biggest driver of that. Even if it doesn't become rich, it's bringing more of its, you know, millions of people into the middle class. So right now, about half of the world's middle class are in the West. And by 2030, two-thirds of them will be in Asia. So the pie is getting bigger because more people are joining the middle class. But the where you're going to find these consumers will be in Asia. And as I said, China is actually a big part of these calculations, just like it is in terms of poverty reduction. So I travel a great deal. So my favorite indicator of ascendancy is actually airports. So this is a Skytrax survey from last year, which captures the best airports in the world. And so half of them are actually in Asia. Four of them are in Europe, and Doha in the Middle East. So I'm actually pleased that Heathrow is on this list, because sometimes I get to Heathrow and I'm like, oh, God. And so actually President Trump is right. America's infrastructure is probably, you know, could do with a bit of retooling. So I hope I've given you at least a sense, I think, of even if China doesn't become rich, and let me just say one more word about that before I move to more of the 21st century. On current projections, it's not going to be rich by 2030 because of the gap that I showed you. But it's going to work really hard to get there, and that's the Chinese motivation. And even if it doesn't get there and it continues to grow at current rates, you're going to find that China is going to dominate quite a lot of consumer markets. And so, again, if you're thinking about foreign economic policy, it's about linking to the biggest markets in the world, which are already the U.S. and China. And this trend is going to continue, and more of the consuming power is actually going to come out of China and Asia. But a lot of this is China. So in thinking about, you know, just to pause and say, you know, if, so as China tries to pursue this policy of growing prosperous, the things that it's going to look for are, one, technological upgrading. So the reason why China has a Made in China 2025 plan, which is trying to make Chinese key industries much more AI-driven, technologically driven. They want to be the tech leaders in these areas. It's because if you wanted to grow prosperous, you have to do it by making your existing economy more efficient, more productive. It's not about adding more capital or people. It's about making that capital and people more efficient. I remember China is unusual because it is a second biggest economy in the world, but it is a middle-income country. So it has a very unusual set of expectations around how much the state should play in making that happen. So, for instance, the Made in China 2025 strategy essentially says that by next year, 40% of inputs into Chinese manufacturing in these key sectors, biotech and others, have to be Chinese domestic content. So that implies that today, Chinese domestic content in terms of feed-ins into high-tech industries is probably only about a third. And by 2025, they want to increase that to 70%. So it's a very ambitious task. And what they're doing is the easiest way to acquire technology and to upgrade is to buy the companies that have the technology. And so that sort of explains also their outward foreign investment. But the problem, and here's, it's obvious, but the problem is that you can buy IBM's PC business, which is what Chinese company Lenovo did, but you can't buy Apple. So the technology you buy is not necessarily going to be the cutting-edge technology. So that's one prong of the Chinese motivation. The other prong of the motivation worth pointing out is that a lot of Chinese reforms are centered on stability. So if you want to reform the Chinese economy, rebalance it, promote certain sectors, open up the economy because you are trying to introduce more competition and learn and partner with companies that are already more advanced in either tech or services, that process, I think, is worth thinking about, because in many ways it would benefit China to actually partner and learn, because that's how they upgraded manufacturing. So China today, the services sector is bigger than manufacturing. So it should partner up with services companies, for instance, from Britain, not the United States, not in a trade war, who can offer that partnership. But the challenge is, of course, entrenched interests in the services sector around the state-owned sector, the state-controlled sector, who dominate quite a lot of the services sector. And politically, it's actually much harder to do that as a result. But thinking about how China can learn and not reinvent the wheel on a number of things, if it can partner, then it can do the reforms in a more stable way rather than experiment, fail, which is roughly speaking how they did manufacturing upgrading. So China is very good at experimenting, but the stakes are much higher to get it right, especially around financial services. So the old models may not necessarily work. So some of you will know that China nearly went a private sector route in the early part of the reform period. So the Zhejiang model was that China introduced private sector, private enterprises. And today, Zhejiang province, north of Shanghai, still has one of the highest concentration of private firms. Still has high concentration of private firms, but they opted for the township and village enterprise model. So they experiment, it doesn't work, and then they do something else. But if you think about financial sector development, you have to get the sequence of reforms right. So partnering actually becomes more important to do that. So again, understanding their need for stability, their need for reforms that are probably properly sequenced now, more than so than before, I think offers opportunities to think about how to help China achieve this goal of upgrading their industries and their services, because high-tech industries have a lot to do with services. The definition of a high-tech industry, one definition, is called advanced manufacturing. So advanced manufacturing is basically industries that have a high component of R&D. So most industries that they're trying to move into is heavily linked with services. It's called the servicification of manufacturing. So for instance, the Rolls-Royce. So if you own a Rolls-Royce, okay. If you've flown in an airplane, I was about to say, probably be, most of you know Rolls-Royces as cars. No one's going to admit they own a Rolls-Royce now that I've said this. But Rolls-Royce makes more money servicing its engines than selling engines. So when we talk about Chinese partnering and services in high-tech industries, this is what I mean. You're actually doing it on high-tech and services, because so much of this sector, this segment, is R&D intensive. So it's actually, you can't really separate the two. So if Britain, which is very good on high-tech services as well as high-tech manufacturing, this is another way of thinking about, of partnering and helping China achieve this goal. And then the final thing to say before I move on to the 21st century setting is that the other aim I think China has is around providing much better, social services. So it doesn't want a big welfare state. So the state government spending on social services in China is like the East Asia model. So government spending as a share of GDP is around 20%. So you compare that to the OECD average or the European average, which is more like 50% of GDP in some of these countries. China actually has a fairly small welfare state. So what they actually need for an aging population and an inadequate health insurance system is a private system. So again, rather than reinventing, you know, the wheel, the best way to stimulate competition in the sector would be to open up the sector. So there's a lot more examples, but I thought I would just stress the partnership possibilities, Chinese aims, which are about upgrading industry and services, and also stability. Because the final word on services is that the reason why China has slowed down in terms of growth rates a lot. So growth is probably down to around 6% now. I say around because, you know, it's hard to say. But people consumption is actually rising. And, you know, it is because you expect the economy to slow down when you become middle income and approach upper middle income status. So that's actually part of what you would expect. So if, China grew at 4%, there'd be a lot of worried people. If the United States grew at 4%, that's all President Trump would be tweeting about. So as China grows richer, the growth rate is going to slow. But employment is very strong in China because it's moved toward the services sector. So if you wanted stability, you need to create jobs. Services is labor intensive. Manufacturing is capital intensive. They move from a capital intensive to a labor intensive economy where manufacturing is still big, but services is bigger. So China's employment goal, they've increased that even as the growth rate has slowed. So they've gone from targeting 10 million new jobs a year to 13 million, and they've met it. So again, thinking about why the services sector is so important, you do not want educated, unemployed graduates. You really don't want that. So this is, to me, these are why the growth drivers are they are. And it's just important to bear that in mind, because I'm now going to move to the broader sort of 21st century economy and how Britain should be thinking about positioning itself and then tying it together. So what are the global trade trends that the UK should be thinking about in terms of its foreign economic policy? So the first thing is digitalization of trade. So the 1 in 8 cross-border transactions today are e-commerce. 5 years ago, that number was negligible. And so the example of this is, Chris kindly mentioned my book. So if you buy my book in e-form, which is cheaper, I shouldn't be broadcasting this so much, but you don't get a physical book. It's now code, right, that downloads into an e-book. So digitalization of trade means you could reduce the trade in physical goods. At the same time, you're actually increasing information and it's erasing borders. So the digitalization of trade is something we don't fully understand, but the implications of which I think are considerable. So if you wanted to think about one of the fastest growing trade trends, it is actually around data, it's around e-commerce, it's around digitalization. And this is complementing some of the localization of supply chains, which is happening because people want to consume locally and they want to produce locally, and it's better for the environment to do so, plus other technological change like 3D printing, which means you can print things locally. You no longer, for instance, have to get a part from somewhere else. So, for instance, pretty much every airplane you currently fly on has a 3D printed part. So instead of waiting to get a part from another place, you basically print it yourself to the perfect specification. So I'm pointing this out because we don't fully understand the impact of technology. These are probably a couple of the effects. But if Britain wanted to position itself, this is the trend, obviously, I think, to watch. The other one is services export growth. So since 1980, services exports have actually increased significantly, even without significant market opening. So GATS, which is the equivalent to the trade in goods, so this is the services agreement under the WTO, hasn't opened up services markets as much. Britain is the world's second biggest exporter of services after only the United States. And if you look at where services are going, it's tracking the trends I picked up in terms of middle-class consumers consuming services for the first time, education, you know, consultancy services, banking services. They have money to save. So this trend is something that Britain is actually very well positioned to take advantage of, even aside from partnering with China. So services growth is one of the things to think about. And imagine if you did have, I'm going to come to this, a market opening agreement on services, the biggest beneficiaries would be the United States and Britain. Oh, I forgot the biggest advantage of partnering with China on services. So China's quite worried about the U.S. for obvious reasons. And so when I was in China recently, I was told, oh, the U.S., you know, the U.S. is keeping us down. U.S. wants to keep us down. And I said, Britain doesn't. So the other thing just to think about is services trade and trade deficits. So that's Britain and the U.S. The current account deficit, if you look at the broadest measure, which includes investment flows, services export economies, you know, the not all of them, but Japan and Germany have obviously a bigger manufacturing sector. Because you're talking now about export of services, the invisibles trade, payment, investments, we can talk about this, but the gauge of the aim of foreign economic policy, it's okay to have a trade deficit, I guess is what I'm trying to say. You don't have to, the aim doesn't need to be a trade surplus. So we can come back to this, but I know that this gets mentioned quite a lot these days around mercantilism. But do trade deficits matter? So the US and UK there, you know, it's coming, so, you know, just it's the same, just wanted to stress, it's actually a very long-standing trade deficit for both countries. So we can talk about a bit about it, but in terms of, you know, mercantilism, which is this idea you should run trade surpluses, it was a theory that was seemingly defeated by the repeal of the Corn Laws in 1846. And at that point, countries believed they should run trade surpluses. Even better, if you can find some gold and silver and bring it back. That's even, you know, that's even better. And so, but, you know, as Mark Twain says, history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. And now we seem to be having the same conversations about trade surpluses and mercantilism. But I want to, final thought on trade and services, and then move into some thoughts about Britain and economic diplomacy specifically. So TISA was launched in 2013. It was the hope of countries that represented mostly services economies, so advanced economies, so the EU, US, Japan, were pushing for a round to open global services markets. And so the Trade and Services Agreement was picking up on the fact that services comprises 70% of world GDP and 70% of the EU GDP, but only 25% of external trade. So markets could be more open on services. Of course, services are also partly non-tradable, so not all services are tradable. So manufacturing goods are all tradable for the most part. Services are partly non-tradable. So, for instance, if you get a haircut, you do it locally. Oh, no, I shouldn't have used that example, because the last time I gave that example, I was in a panel with the chief economist of a major bank, and he said, oh, Linda, that's a terrible example. My wife gets her hair cut in Paris. So, okay, local restaurant. You're going to eat locally, right? Now you're going to tell me about being flown to Italy for pizza or something. But so anyway, so you're not going to expect necessarily services to be all tradable, but there's still significant scope to increase it. TISA would have given foreign firms the same treatment as domestic firms. That's the WTO principle of non-discrimination. So the potential is huge, and services opening is one of the things I want you to think about as I look at the UK as a global trade hub before I finish with some thoughts about economic diplomacy. So can the UK be a global trade hub? Let me be specific for services. So I've talked about growth in services trade. The UK is 80% services in its economy. The new global middle class, including China, are trying to consume more services. Can the UK be a global trading hub for services? So first of all, what is a global trading hub? I'm going to show you a few pictures of free trade agreements, and then I'll answer that question. So the first thing is, these are EU trade agreements. So the EU has a lot of trade agreements. The EU trade agreements, some of them are suspended, but they've got a lot of them. And where the EU doesn't have free trade agreements is with China, and they're not trying. TTIP with the US is no longer proceeding, and you can see other major economies there like India. But the EU, generally speaking, has free trade agreements, but not with these major economies. And it was doing a free trade agreement with ASEAN, the 10 nations of Southeast Asia, but now they're doing it individually. So you can also see that on the map. The US has only 14 free trade agreements with 20 countries. It has actually very few. And you can see there, the US does not have a free trade agreement with the EU. It does not have a free, will not have a free trade agreement with China. China has 14 free trade agreements, mostly in the Asian region, except for a few Latin American countries. So China also doesn't have a lot of free trade agreements. So what is a global trade hub? The Commonwealth. The Commonwealth would be, if it was a free trade area, the biggest trading bloc in the world. The reason I mention it is because more business gets done with Commonwealth countries for British businesses because there's shared institutions, common legal tradition, and those kinds of things. So bear that in mind. So what is a global trading hub? The UK would link countries without free trade agreements with each other and be a hub for trading services. So a couple of examples. Israel, until the early 1990s, was the only country with a free trade agreement with the EU and the United States. It put Israel in a very privileged position in terms of trade going through Israel to link these two countries. Mexico has a free trade agreement with the EU. So that meant a U.S. car company that produced in Mexico could export to the EU and pay 0% tariffs. The same car company in America exporting directly would pay 10% on tariff. So that made Mexico a trading hub. So to be a global trading hub for services is you would have free trade agreements or not even a free trade agreement. I'm talking very specifically around TISA terms, opening up markets for services trade. That's how you become a global trade hub, linking together countries to go through you. So how likely is it for the UK to become a global trading hub? Let's see. EU, biggest trading partner. We do not have time for me to talk about Brexit. So let's just leave it at that. But there will be one, or we stay in or something like that. The USA, President Trump is more interested in leaving FTAs, but he will do bilateral trade agreements. That was what was discussed this week. But just remember, reports were the author of the art of the deal likes to win. Mm. So apparently, even if the UK-US trade agreement was a win for the UK, you can't say that, apparently. We have to keep it to ourselves, is what the reports say. So negotiating with the US is going to be tough. So should that be a priority for the UK? That's one question we can come back to. Focusing on China, the point of this lecture, the UK is actually pretty well placed because it's not the US, second biggest exporter of services, and it's a very, it's an economy whose comparative advantage offers what China is trying to develop. High-tech manufacturing, lots of R&D, very strong education and skills industries, as well as expertise in a range of services. It doesn't have some of the other issues that tend to make trade deals problematic, like lower-end manufacturing. The UK just doesn't have a lot of that. So it's arguably better placed to do a trade deal with China than almost any other major economy because of the services specialization, the area that China is actually trying to develop. But China is an economic superpower. And there's a Chinese, almost like a joke, which is when the Chinese say doing this deal is a win-win, that means that China wins twice. And obviously, there's also the Commonwealth, the historic links to think about, because it's actually easier to do trade deals with smaller countries you already do a lot of business with, and you just formalize it. And then when you make mistakes, you learn for the next deal. And so you could go for instance, Commonwealth countries a little bit less. But I want to focus back on China. So this is, I think, thinking about how Britain might position itself in the 21st century, thinking about what's actually driving global trade and the interest of its major trading partners like China. But what are the economic diplomacy considerations around doing being a global trade hub for services? It might be an optimal outcome in terms of foreign economic policy, isolated, but what are the other implications? So for instance, what if you can't do a trade deal on services with both the US and China? So in NAFTA 2.0, that's not what it's called, but okay, the problem with the new NAFTA is that the name in the U.S. is USMCA, I'm going to get it slightly wrong, but the U.S. comes first. And so, yeah. In Canada, it starts with C, Canada. In Mexico, it starts with M, because NAFTA was North American Free Trade Agreement, so that was okay. But the convention for other countries is you put your own country first. So I don't know what to call NAFTA 2.0 anymore. I just call it NAFTA 2.0. But within that, remember, there was a discussion where the U.S. wanted to limit Mexico and Canada's ability to do trade agreements with non-market economies. And which is the big non-market economy? China. This is a WTO designation. China's been fighting for years, trying to get the U.S. and EU to designate it as a market economy for trade purposes. So the big difference is if you're a non-market economy, if you're accused of dumping, they use other countries' costs to judge whether you're dumping. If you're a market economy, your own costs get considered. So being a market economy is a big deal in WTO terms, but China is a non-market economy. So if you had to choose, you couldn't do a deal with both the US and China. That may make this trade hub thing slightly complicated. What if China pursues different standards and rules than the U.S. and the EU? So Huawei is a bit in the news. So 5G is a standard. And the Belt and Road Initiative, the digital part of the infrastructure, uses Chinese standards. And so what if services, by the way, which are all about standards and regulations, what if you have different standards and rules? So that makes it a lot more complicated when you're talking about opening a sector which is based on non-tariff measures. So tariffs are taxes. That applies to manufacturing. So being a global trade hub for manufacturing is about, there's standards too, but a lot of it is around tariffs but services is all about standards. And so this, I think, is one of the other things to think about. And what about for foreign policy? The questions that I said I would touch on, but I look forward to more discussion around it. So China is not a democracy. So would prioritizing a trade and investment deal with China be consistent with a values-based approach to British foreign policy? So, how do you reconcile this economic opportunity, which I think I've hopefully outlined in terms of why we're actually a natural partner in many ways for China's next stage of development, with the fact that foreign policy towards China is very, fraught, with lots of issues around human rights, a lot of issues around the extent to which China is not an open society. These are all things which, if the UK is going to be doing a values-based foreign policy around democracy being the link for democracies and promoting those values, how do you reconcile the economic opportunities with the foreign policy considerations? Can you do both sensibly, pursue a foreign policy that fits your foreign policy needs, or are the two linked? So in many ways, China for many years pursued economic policy actually quite separately from its political stance. So if you did deals in China, if you did negotiations in China, the economic and business parts were actually much more open, and they always separated that from the politics. But for a country to set economic diplomacy, surely some consistency must be had in terms of a values-based approach if the values include democracy. And I'm just using one example. There's others as well in terms of what you do. And then what are the domestic constraints on foreign policy? So would further globalization, and remember, China's big, the China shock, which is how China affected U.S. manufacturing when it acceded to the World Trade Organization and China began to really grow rapidly in the 1990s. It was a huge shock to the mid-skilled sector in the U.S. economy. Now, of course, that era for China has largely passed, and obviously a lot of that shock was intertwined with technological change. Technology is probably more important in many ways, but doing a deal with a country the size of China, opening up equivalent UK markets to China, and what are the distributional consequences in terms of opening up services to a Chinese financial system, for instance, that's still largely state-controlled and certainly state-dominated. So Chinese credit is a lot cheaper because of the state subsidies for key industries. So is there a level playing field? So those are the kinds of, and the distributional consequences for the country. Some regions may be able to manage, but are there going to be other regions that will be dominated by opening up to China in the same way? So it'd be the services equivalent of the China shock, which has been measured for manufacturing. And also, coming back to thinking about it as a domestic constraint, foreign economic policy, like foreign policy, will be constrained by domestic politics. So if globalization is already under challenge, which it is, would further opening up worsen that challenge? There's already concerns about, lots of concerns about whether globalization has left too many people behind in this country. So is there political support for opening up to the world's second biggest economy with such numbers and a dominance? And that's one thing to think about. So my final thought on this is, one of the decisions Britain will have to take is the fair play rule in football. So there's a fair play rule in football. So Manchester City is in trouble because obviously financial fair play means that, you know, they spend too much money on players and all this kind of stuff. So the rule in football is it doesn't matter where the money comes from so long as you play fairly on the field. The other version of this rule is it does matter where the money comes from, whether it's a government or whether it's private. So do you judge the source of the money or the conduct on the field? So that's one of the considerations. So the, thinking about, again, China's system, which is a lot more state-led in terms of supporting industries and cheap credit, is in huge negotiations with the United States right now. It's part of the U.S.-China trade tensions. If this is, and China is pretty insistent, this is how they're going to become prosperous because they need to have state-led development to overcome the middle-income country trap. So Britain has to decide, is it opening up to, big services companies, which are, probably going to be able to access cheaper credit than British companies. So is it fair play or is it the source of the money? So conclusions is I think the new middle global middle class led by China, but increasingly, I think if you project it out further, it'll be Asia as well in the next decade, could usher in a golden age of growth. So the middle class that I'm describing, we've never seen this before historically. The United States, with about 200, 250 million people in the post-war period, was the main engine of growth during the golden age of growth in the 50s and 60s. We're now talking about 5 billion people who could be middle class and leading this growth. So it could be another golden age of growth. So I think the prospects of 21st century are actually probably really pretty bright in terms of just lifting people finally out of abject poverty and into the middle class. Digital and services trade are growing really rapidly, and that's really good news for the UK. These are areas in which Britain is actually very good at, you know, both in terms of digitalization and in terms of services. These are the areas which play to Britain's strengths. And I think the UK is well placed to be a global trade hub. A few questions there around China that we've talked about. But we don't, and I'm happy to, I look forward to, you know, speculating some more on a lot of these economic diplomacy answers. But I would say this is the reason we have this LSE commission, because a lot of these answers are going to require a lot more analysis, evidence, thinking, and thinking about goals. So the potential to be a global trade hub, the economic potential, I think, is immense. But the question is how you square that with economic diplomacy in general and still hold true to the values that define this nation. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Linda. That was wonderful, and you kind of came back to those dilemmas at the end that I mentioned in my introductory remarks on dilemmas that I think we're all having to face now at an individual, institutional, or national level. Really very serious dilemmas with opportunities and huge risks on both sides. So thank you very much indeed. Rather than abuse my position as chair, I should open up now to questions and answers, unless no one has a question yet, but I'm sure you do. That gentleman at the front.
Thank you very much.
And could you introduce yourself?
Sorry, yeah. My name is David Lubin. I'm an economist at Citi and also, like Linda, affiliated with Chatham House. There's a difference, I think, between economic dominance and financial dominance. China is on its way to achieving economic dominance. It's by no means on its way to achieving financial dominance, because the international financial system is still overwhelmingly dollar-dominated and will remain so for many, many years. When you think about Britain's position in the services industry, it's still overwhelmingly the financial services that Britain excels at, or that Britain sells. And I wonder if that constrains Britain's ability to make use of its future relationship with China, because one of the things that China worries about, I think, is building up any dependence on the dollar financial system, because what we've seen over the last few years is the US kind of placing less priority on the use of military power, much more priority and very successfully on its leverage in the international economic and financial system. And so the sort of application of financial sanctions, particularly with Iran, has been extremely effective. And so countries that don't have great relationships with the United States would do well to kind of avoid building up exposure to the dollar. So I wonder if you think that might kind of constrain this future relationship between China and Britain on services.
Yeah, it's a great question, David. And I think one of the things to think about is the financial system is a huge part of the services exports. That's absolutely true. And China, in its own way, has a really dominant financial system within the country. So the areas in which they probably want to upgrade are probably around expertise rather necessarily, China's there's China's bond market is probably the biggest in the world. The stock market is already one of the biggest in the world. The financial system has huge amounts of assets. So I'm thinking more about partnering in terms of expertise rather than necessarily, because you're right, the dollar-dominated system. And also, I would probably say, I would think of it as services writ large. So within the domestic economy, financial services is big, but there's plenty of other services as well. So, you know, things like education, one of the services that there's great Chinese universities, but there's not enough of them because China graduates 10 million graduates a year. And so this is why we're lucky enough to have so many good Chinese students here. And so education is actually one of the sectors that's very open. And you can see how well Britain does in terms of exporting services. And so in education, so legal services, these are the consultancy, business services. There's a range of things which are about expertise to help China develop, which I think is worth, you know, thinking about. So I think the financial services is probably, I'm not suggesting that British financial institutions wouldn't like to do more business in China, because I'm sure they would. I know they would. But I think, working within China and then partnering with China to help develop some of the sectors, those are probably more the services that I'm thinking about. But eventually, you know, we'll see whether or not the conflict between the dollar and the RMB comes to some kind of head anyways, because you mentioned Iran. Iran now prices oil in RMB, so they can evade sanctions and not go through the U.S. financial system. There's a lot more of that, I think, happening. So,
gentleman in the black T-shirt.
Hi, thank you very much for your speech, first of all. And my name's Gidon. I'm a student at the LSE, and I work at LSE Ideas. I have two questions, if I'm allowed.
He works at Ideas.
Short, quick, very quick.
Okay, I'll try and make it quick. So, first of all, also related to financial services, there are some areas like fintechs and neobanking where arguably the UK itself is also in the process of learning of how exactly to regulate these upcoming sectors. So how do you see the potential for UK-Chinese partnership in those areas where the UK itself is also still learning? And then secondly, given everything you've said about the potential for the relationship, some may say that Chinese interest is surprisingly low. So how would you explain that? What are the key bottlenecks and how can they be overcome?
So sorry, Chinese interests are surprisingly low.
Yeah, in terms of proactivity and engaging with the UK side.
Oh, yeah, so we're not in the golden age anymore, are we? So I think on the, I think on the first, on the first question, I think the idea of partnering doesn't necessarily mean that it would be areas in which the UK has deep expertise. Actually, regulation is one of those areas. Nobody knows how to regulate fintech. And actually, Chinese fintech is really developing very, very quickly. And in fact, the biggest countries for fintech are the US, UK, and China. And so you could actually probably work together to provide some type of regulatory framework. But actually where they could partner really in terms of what the UK could offer is actually deep regulatory experience. A lot of the Chinese financial system, China had only one bank until market-oriented reform started. PBOC was the only bank in China. Under central planning, no one had any money, so you didn't need a bank. And so, the CBRC was established in 2003, so that's the Chinese China Banking Regulatory Commission. And so in that sense, I think Britain's very deep history with financial regulation and all of that is actually really useful. And nobody gets it wrong all the time. That's, it's fine to make mistakes and move on, financial crisis, 10 years ago. So I think in that sense, I would think, so what China's very, very good at, I think, is they learn from the best. So they're very good at picking out the best benchmarks, learning from mistakes of other countries. And, some of you will know this, but when the Chinese sent a delegation to visit, something here, you're probably expecting like two people and there'll be 20. Because they're here to really pick up the best bits. And then they adapt it to what works in China. So what I'm suggesting is that's the kind of partnership we should be really open to. The second question around that Chinese productivity is low. Was that the?
No, just sort of the.
The interest in China is low. Okay, yeah, sorry. I think some Chinese policymakers are. The thing about diplomacy is it's all based on relationships. So, you know, you have to spend the time. So I think profile depends on, building those relationships. So maybe we don't hear about it because the British government is a little busy at the moment. things are still happening, but maybe, the time to build those relationships, there's not as much time. I refer to sort of the golden age. I think there was a lot more time building the relationships then, because that was clearly a policy focus. So one of the debates that we should all have is around what should the UK prioritize in terms of building relationships and focus. So we just had President Trump come through talking trade deals, how many can you really kind of focus on at once? That's one of the questions that we'll have to look at, which is, what do you prioritize? Is it smaller countries, for instance, who be fostered to do a deal? Like Canada says, we can cross out EU and write in UK on the CETA free trade agreement with the EU, sorry? Okay. So, it may be that Commonwealth countries are a bit easier to do. So, is the interest in China there? I would say I think so. I just don't think the British government has as much time building these relationships they have in the past, but they're definitely doing something. So the question is, how worried is China about Brexit? It had to be said, we are going to end up on Brexit at some point, which is, so I've certainly heard Chinese policymakers worry the UK will no longer be the gateway to the EU. From their side, is the UK a priority in terms of talking, trade. But remember, we're the world's fifth biggest economy, second biggest exporter of services, and we're not the United States. So, should at least be higher than that.
Okay. There are a few people waiting to answer, and I'll come to you, but we take inclusivity very seriously at the LSE because you're all men, and I just wonder if there are any women who want to ask a question. I would encourage you. If not, then I think there's someone at the front here. Gordon, was it?
Yes.
Someone here raised their hand. Yeah.
Colin, you had something to follow up with.
Sorry, yeah.
If I may.
Yeah. Can you say who you are?
Colin Butt, formerly of the Foreign Office, but also with Ideas. I just wanted to ask, I see perfectly well that on one side, people in China today will see a disadvantage of us no longer being in the EU if that happens. But what opportunities and advantages would they see of our being separate?
Great question. So I think one of the things to think about is if Britain, were separate, it would have the ability to craft. If Britain leaves the EU, then, for instance, I was about to mention the withdrawal agreement, but I probably shouldn't because it's not going to be. But the carving out of services in the withdrawal agreement suggests that the UK has a lot more flexibility to set those, non-tariff measures. So you have more freedom in crafting that. No longer at the Foreign Office, but, there will be more freedom in crafting that rather than. So, for instance, let's take the example of Norway. Norway has a free trade agreement with China. And because in Norway is essentially in the single market vis-a-vis being an EEA. So it has actually less freedom around some things because the rules on the what's called Mode 5 services are constrained by, the EU. You comply with the EU rules essentially in the single market. So in that sense, if Britain was out, it would have more freedom to decide and to craft things. Now, one of the challenges that I see generally, and I did say this as well, is that China tends to have different standards than other countries on tech, certainly on services. So if the UK were to do a deal with China, it probably needs to think about how those norms that it agrees to would be consistent with doing the trade deals with the other two. So, you know, so those are the kinds of things that I'm thinking about. So, for instance, Norway's free trade agreement with China probably gives it an advantage, but not as much, because, like I said, it is quite tied. It's very tied to the EU single market.
Some people here will want to stay that way, too. Yeah,
yeah, so the Norway model is one possibility for Britain, you know, but that would, you know, mean, for instance, financial regulation. The Bank of England wouldn't be setting regulation. It would be the ECB. And, you know, the governor, Mark Carney, has already said that would be quite difficult for the UK financial system. So those are the kinds of things that I'm thinking about. You know.
I still know women want to ask a question. I think...
Is it Jonathan?
Yeah. Hi, Jonathan. Yeah, it's the next. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm Jonathan Liebenow from the Department of Management here at LSE. In studying the digital economy in Britain, one sees extraordinary concentration in London. That's true also of the financial services. Will this play well in UK domestic policy? It looks like, a lot of the rhetoric for Brexit in any case focuses extraordinarily disproportionately on manufacturing industry. When it comes to looking at how digital trade is going to occur, it's going to be way overwhelmingly London-based. And we'll see that our trade relations with China are not at all distributed across the country. And the nations will feel that in particular. That's a major concern. I'm wondering whether you have a view on domestic policy. The other point about standards, I wrote a piece on standards in the Belt and Road Initiative, and it's certainly the case that the Chinese have never modified any standards of any kind, procedural, technical, in terms of the gauge of railways, electronic components. None of them have been modified for any of the countries that they've done any of that trade with so far.
Yeah, that's exactly a great illustration of what I mean by the standards. In terms of distribution, I mean, fintech, for instance, you know, so just one example of, you know, some of this digital based banking. You know, a lot of it is based around the existing financial centers. So London and Edinburgh, for instance, is also, you know, yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Really? Not,
yeah, so I think this is why I pointed out the domestic consideration. So if you were to open up, you know, to China, would it actually worsen the concentration of high-end services? And this is a really difficult question because it's actually a question that China confronts as well. So 3/4 of Chinese GDP is on its coast. That means the rest of the country, you know, is very much, is a big divide. And so...
They have mechanisms to change that.
There are.
And they're growing fast. So
yeah, and also the thing about digital trade is you could do it from anywhere. So, you know...
It's done from London.
Yeah, but I suppose in theory, you know, this is what China is thinking about, is that it develops across, you know, they're creating something called the Greater Bay Area that links, like, you know, 10 provinces across, you know, southern China. They're trying to connect digital infrastructure as well as physical infrastructure. And the idea is to spread the ability to do, you know, e-commerce, digitalization trade from wherever you are, because you don't need a physical location to do it. It's about whether you have the digital infrastructure to do it. And so that is why, in theory, you could see much more spread across the country if you had the digital infrastructure to back it up. And that's the big question. So,
you had your hand up a long time ago. Did you want to still ask?
Yes. I'd like to. Because of, in the interest of diversity and all that,
Please, go ahead.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Yao Ming. I'm an accountant by profession. My question is regarding this. We're talking about the dollar dominance. I've read in the news about, you know, some futures in Shanghai oil futures, you know, being settled in renminbi and all that. And increasingly there's more. And there's also talk about a separate payment system, something like that, CIPS or something. Could you expand on that and how it's developing so far? And how this country perhaps could contribute to that development?
This is not an area I've really looked at. I think a lot of what China is developing is very fast, especially around, payment systems. They obviously have their own systems. And so this is another issue around what could, being a hub for systems that are developed entirely on their own standards, regulations, norms, programming, is that possible? My suspicion is it probably is, because if it's electronic payments, it probably is not too challenging. But like I said, specifically, I'm not an expert in this area.
Because I was reading as well, like renminbi trading in London, the volume is actually greater than euro trading. So ready in the FT, I think. So it's quite...
RMB trading. There is quite a lot of it. Yeah. So I think, being an offshore trading hub for the RMB is around the UK's deep FX markets and experience. This is about, the UK is also a major offshore, just a major FX trading hub. You know, something like, I can't remember the exact statistic, but something like, definitely more than half of global FX trading actually happens in London. So, and this is not really related to, so the UK can maintain that position. However, I don't see that as being much of a, in fact, that's one of the key things to keeping the UK as a global trade hub for services. I don't really see that necessarily being affected by Brexit so much and, because... the UK was an FX trading hub before, really the single market really began to take hold, as in really solidify. So,
could you pass the microphone? I'll come to you in a minute, Gordon. There's a lady right at the back there.
Hi, my name's Megan. I'm actually a Canadian expat living here in London who previously lived in Singapore. And I've traveled to a number of those airports, and I do agree by far, Singapore's airport is the best. You've actually somewhat answered a bit of the question I was going to ask, but I'll still ask anyway. Given that it seems Brexit looks like it's almost inevitable, given the tone of the conversations taking place with those who want to succeed Theresa May, do you think that your discussions about Britain becoming a global service hub, will that hold if Brexit does move forward?
The only certainty about Brexit is uncertainty. we leave on October 31st, then I actually think it's more important than ever to quickly do a free trade agreement with the EU and essentially become a global trade hub in services. Actually makes it, the ambitions of the UK around being a global Britain, I think a lot of that, is even... Yeah, probably more important. The question is, if we stay in the EU, in some capacity, I think it complicates that, which we began to talk about a moment ago, around if we went, Norway model or something, it actually makes it a lot more complicated. Sorry, am I not getting the gist of the question?
No, I think you answered. The second part which I can ask is, in relation to
Yeah.
Will
Speak into the microphone, thanks.
Yeah. I guess, sorry, I didn't ask the second part of my question, is given under the current president, certainly, how the U.S. is asserting its economic and foreign policy muscle as best it's trying to anyway, let's say, how will that complicate issues for the U.K. should it want to develop this relationship, deepen its relationship with China?
Yeah, so I think, you know, that's certainly one of the implications that I was, you know, highlighting, which is America is very vocal about the UK not granting, for instance, Chinese company Huawei, you know, into Britain, you know. And so and this is really tricky. It really actually is, because in many ways, the clash of superpowers is not going to end anytime soon, even if the U.S. administration changes. I think this is a deep-seated rivalry between a new superpower and the existing superpower. I don't think they're going to do the, you know, the even so this trade war will end before the 2020 presidential elections. Nobody puts a dampener in an election year, but it won't really end. It'll just be, you know, a pause. So I think this deeper rift. So it poses a really interesting challenge for Britain, which is, on foreign policy, it's been a close ally to the U.S. We've just pointed out how China and Asia have massive opportunities economically. So, you know, how it sits will matter a great deal. So one of the things that, you know, again, this commission will, I'm sure, explore in much more detail that I've been sort of thinking about in terms of this question is, you know, being forced to choose is not nice. But the reason why we have to promote values and a multilateral system is that a rules-based multilateral system based on values that are universal, that's how we would... we could position ourselves because we are almost the, you know, we're not, anything the U.S. sets, China's not going to follow. China sets, U.S. is not going to follow. So what if we set it? What if we're the ones who promote the universal values, compromising on standards, putting forward a rules-based system that everyone has input into to govern the 21st century global economy based on digital trade and services. You know, it could be the British century if we got that right.
Gordon.
Why is everyone laughing?
So, Linda, thank you. First of all, Gordon Barris, ex-FCO, PricewaterhouseCoopers, spent a lot of time in China. And I just was really very grateful to you in the way you've illuminated many of these issues that occur in thinking about our relations with China. But also just stepping back a little, and I expect this is something you're dealing with in your commission, is that Britain faces a huge number of issues, regardless of Brexit, because these issues now are not just concerning trade, they're concerning trade and security, because there are, watching what has been going on both in terms of technologies and Chinese attitudes towards technology, and trying to have dominance in the market, these pose really significant threats to people. So there is a huge, it seems to me there's a huge amount of thinking any government, when we have a working government in place, is going to have to be thinking about, because this is not just about our relations with China, but the whole question of what is Europe as an entity going to do, looking after its security, which can't be separated from its economic.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't have an answer, because I think that's exactly what the Commission will need to look at. And Huawei is the current example, but it will not be the last example. So, you know, something economic, maybe it works economically, but if it threatens the Five Eyes alliance, you know, what is the... So, yeah, this is, you know... Thank you, yes.
So one last one, I think, yeah.
Oh, I think...
Was it him? Yeah. Was it?
Oh, yeah, no, he's a friend.
Oh, is it? do you want me to stop him?
No, go ahead. I was going to say.
Yes, thank you.
I do it quickly with season two.
Yes, thank you. Just touch on a bit more about banking. Recent report by Bank of Lincoln highlight that the UK actually have a lot of bank exposure to China, more than the US and the Eurozone and Japan and Korea combined. What are your view about this? Is it something to be encouraged or something to be worried about? And if it is something to be encouraged, how more can you to you know, more leverage on it? Another question is about the values play in the UK's part. I don't see much of a problem given that the UK already do very good relations and trade with Saudi Arabia and I do not see a problem at all. What is values happening now? Thank you.
Yeah, no, great question. The latter part of that is economic diplomacy. I'm only focused on China, but obviously we could do this lecture on Saudi Arabia, on the U.S., same issues. Slightly different issues, I would say, but same general issues. So this is not to single that out for China in particular. There's obviously lots of countries we've already identified on this commission as we need to look at. In terms of the banking exposure, the London-China Stock Connect, there's a lot of links. FX trading, access to the stock market, QAFI licenses, RQAFI licenses. So there's a lot of exposure already. So a couple of things to say is I think the British financial system wants to do more business in China, so they don't actually think it's enough. But one thing that is always in the back of my mind is China has grown well for about 40 years, not consistently, but well, without a financial crisis. So it will have a financial crisis. I don't know when, otherwise, but it will have one. Every major economy has one. So it means the UK is more exposed. But I suppose that would be the issue for investing and opening up to any emerging economy. They're always more volatile. You're not as sure they could cope with a crisis. And in many ways, China is probably better positioned to mop up after a crisis. So I think that's probably my sort of quick answer on that.
Okay. Before we say thank you, I just have a couple of things to say. One is that there are some ideas feedback forms, and would you please fill those in to give us some sense of the feedback. And also, the next LSE Ideas event is on the 13th of June, and it's a talk by the Bangladeshi High Commissioner on women's empowerment in Muslim-majority Bangladesh. So you're all very welcome to come, and we hope to see you there. And now, one other thing. There is a reception outside to which you are all invited. So please do join us and talk. And now we can say thank you. Yeah. Thank you.